For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. Okay, tonight's class is a little unique as far as our coursework goes. While I'm getting myself ready here, if you have this map at the beginning of your, or the back, you might want to just take it out. We're going to be using it extensively tonight, so you might want to make sure that you have that available, or if you don't, sit next to somebody who does. Okay, tonight's class is about the development of Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Let me mention also it is dedicated by Judy Garber in memory of her parents, Isidore Wolper, Yisrael Ben Yaakov of blessed memory, and Jeanette Wolper, Shena Bas Aryeh Leib of blessed memory. May their memory be a blessing, and may the course and the study that we do tonight be a source of merit for them. Thank you, Judy, for sponsoring tonight's class. Okay, we're going to touch on the medieval period of the development of Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Now, as I mentioned, this is a little bit of a unique controversy. There is no real controversy in tonight's class. This is not like we're going to be discussing a hatred, a heated battle, a dispute. We just have an interesting development in the Jewish people, which is a fascinating one, and one which we need to spend time discussing. How is it that we ended up with this body that we call Ashkenazim and Sephardim? In a few nights, we're going to light the Hanukkah candles on Wednesday nights. So in Ashkenazic homes throughout the world, there will be many menorahs in each home. A menorah per person in each house. Every child will light. Members of the household will light. You look in the windows and you'll see 8, 6, 4, whatever it is, numbers of menorahs in the home. In Sephardic homes across the world, you will find one menorah. One menorah, different customs. How did we end up here? How did we get to the place where Ashkenazim will not eat rice on Pesach and Sephardim will? How does this happen that we have such different cultures? So tonight's class is going to be the bridge between what we've been discussing, which has been a lot of older history, things which I find personally are much more difficult to relate to because of the fact that it was so long ago. Tonight's class is going to bring us into an era that we're much more familiar with. It's still going to be 1,000 years ago, but it'll bring us into an area that we are familiar with. If you start on your maps, so this is where we're up to in world history. We're going to begin in general medieval period, starting from the 800-900s, moving till about 1500 tonight. That's where we're going to generally cover. On the bottom right, depends on how you're looking at it exactly, is you'll see the land of Eretz Yisrael. And directly to the right of that, in the red and the green, Iraq, Iran, you'll see Baghdad is starred on the bottom right corner of your map. That's where the Jewish people are right now. The Jewish community in Babylonia, in Babel, which is modern-day Iraq, you'll see the two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, coming out of Iraq. That is where the majority of the Jewish population is settled. That community is a 1,500-year-old community. The first Jews arrive in Babylonia prior to the first destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. 11 years before the first temple is destroyed, this is in the times of Yechezkel HaNavi. So we're going back not to last year's class on Great Jewish Books, not to the previous class of Tanakh. When Ezekiel the prophet was alive, 10 years before the destruction, we're in about the year 596 before the Common Era. Almost 600 years before the Common Era, the Jews are exiled, a majority of them, before the destruction of the temple, and they go to Babylonia. And the Talmud discusses how this was a gift that Hashem gave to the Jewish people so that many of the leaders who were exiled prior to the destruction would be able to set up communities, the infrastructure of a community which is needed for Jewish life, schools, kashrus, mikvaos, everything that was necessary. And when the first exile happens, after the first destruction, when the Jews are sent to Babylonia, the community is there for them. 70 years later, the Purim story happens in this area. 70 years later, the Jews return. And a minority actually return, a very small number, 44,000 Jews actually return. The overwhelming majority stay in Babylonia. They stay there for the 400 plus years that the Second Temple stands. They remain in Babylonia. And then when the Second Temple falls in the year 70 into the Common Era now, when it falls at the hands of the Romans, So many Jews are exiled and taken back to Rome and to Italy, which we'll speak about in a few moments. And a great number of them, the majority, actually end up back in Babylonia. And this is where the last week's discussion, if you remember, about the Karaites, that really takes place in the Babylonian community, which now is without the land of Israel in its heyday because the Second Temple has now been destroyed. The Jews are now primarily rooted in Babylonia. That is the seat of Jewish life post Second Temple destruction. We're now talking in the years 200, 300, 400, all the way till about the year 1000. The seat of the Jewish world is in Babylonia. So again, if in your map, you're doing it, where are the Jews in the year 800, in the year 900? Primarily in that area, Israel, Iraq, a little bit in Egypt, that's where they are. There are small pockets that have made their way elsewhere. We will get to that in a few minutes. But the majority of the Jewish world is there. If you remember, we discussed the Gaonim. The Gaonim were the two heads of the yeshivas in Babylonia, Sura and Pumbedisa. Those are yeshivas which existed during the times of the Talmud and continue to exist. And you had the exilarch, who was appointed by, at this point in the year 700, it's already run by the Muslims, who appointed a Jew to run their autonomous government in Babylonia. It is a strong community. It has existed by about the year 1000 for almost 1500 years. And in about the year 900, that's all going to change. And this is where the rest of the world is going to become populated with us. Because right now, at this point, we're in an isolated area. We're in Babylonia. We're in Israel. Today, we're the four corners of the earth. How did that happen? Well, it starts where we're going to pick up with our story tonight in about the year 900. So far, so good? Am I too loud? Not yet? Okay, I'll get there. Mirtz Hashem, I will get there. So beginning in the year 900, the Babylonian Jewish community begins to lose its power and its influence. Now, there are many factors which go into this. When we're talking in broad strokes, looking back 1,000 years in time, so we can describe a couple of points. But over a century, many factors contributed to the fact that the Jewish community basically crumbled and fell apart in Babylonia. Number one, Rav Sadia Gaon, who was one of the last of the great Gaonim, dies in the year 942, and in his death, there's really almost nobody left to take on that mantle of leadership. We also have a constant strife, as we've mentioned last week, between the Gaonim and the Exilarch. It's a place that's filled with rife. It's filled with contention. It's not a unified community as time goes on. There are many economic reasons. As the Muslims have taken over the world, this part of the world at least, starting there in the beginning of the 600s where they come into existence, 700s, 800s, they become much stronger and begin to spread out throughout this area. The trade routes change. And this area of Babylonia is no longer in the center of economic reasons. The Muslims put all sorts of inhibitions upon the Jewish people. They curtail many of the trading rights. Muslims are big into wars, as we discussed a little bit last week as well, which wars cost money, and money is going to come from the constituents. So the Jewish people were heavily taxed. Their property is taken away. They begin to move away from the rural homes of the yeshivas into the big city of Baghdad and others. All these factors come into play, and what happens is, over time, in this period, the center of Jewish life begins to fall apart from Babylonia. Well, when you're running out of economic support, what do you need to do to keep your yeshiva going? Fundraise, correct. Well, as the community begins to spread out and Jews begin to move away, so the yeshivas begin sending fundraisers out to the pockets of communities which exist elsewhere. There are no strong centers yet, but there are Jewish communities elsewhere. So the yeshivas of Babylonia, the communities begin sending out fundraisers to collect money from the Jewish communities to send back to Babylonia to build up the infrastructure and support themselves. Fundraising, as you know, certainly in those days, was not the cleanest of professions. It was difficult to raise money. It was difficult for people to give money, to know that it was going to the right place. And as it became more and more difficult, the yeshivas of Babylonia began sending a higher caliber of fundraiser. You no longer sent the guy who couldn't get a job doing anything else to go collect money because he wasn't successful. You now had to send some of the significant rebbeim, some of the leading rabbis and scholars from the yeshiva were now beginning to travel out to these communities, exposing themselves to these communities to raise funds as they were doing so. And this brings us to one of the great legends in Jewish history. Even tonight we're going to mention three or four different legends. I call them legends because my Rebbe in Jewish history, Rabbi Wine, calls them legends. And the reason why he calls them legends is because this is a time period where we don't have accurate information. We can't verify a lot of the information that we have. But certain stories have made their way down through the chains of Jewish history. And they're part of the way we tell over this history, even though we tell it over as the famous legend, even though we don't have the historical record of it. But one of the most famous legends of this time period, around the year 900, which is the beginning of the expression of how did we get everywhere? How did we end up in all these different lands, is what's known as the story of the four hostages. The story of the four hostages goes that there were four leading sages from the Babylonian community, who I'm not going to mention by name because they're not names that are familiar to us. Four leading sages were on a ship that was traveling from Cordova, Spain, back to Babylonia. And just like today, off the coast of Somalia, you have pirates who like to hijack ships and hold the passengers for ransom. So that's not a new thing that's going on today in the news, as you all know. This has been going on for a long time, and it took place in this time period as well. This story is mentioned by the Ravid, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Daud, in his Sefer HaKabbalah. So it's coming from a very valid source within Jewish history, but he's writing almost 200 years after it happened. He lived from the years 1110 to 1180, and he's writing about a story which took place in 960. So we don't have any historical verification of this, but this has been part of our history. These four sages are on a ship leaving Cordova, Spain, on the way back to Babylonia, and it's hijacked and pirated, and all of the four passengers are sold as slaves to various communities. And each one of the four sages, which we know existed in these four different communities, are sold. One is sold to Alexandria, Egypt, and if you take out your map, I just want to show you where this is. Cordova, Spain. Spain is on the left-hand side of your map. The ship is on its way back to Babylonia, all the way across the Mediterranean Sea. One of the sages ends up being sold to Alexandria, Egypt, which is on the very bottom. And look, if you'll see where it is on Egypt, right over there. Ends up over in there. Another one ends up in Quran in Morocco, which is on the left-hand corner of the North African continent, on the bottom left of your map. You see that? You see Morocco. We don't have the actual city of Quran there. And a third ends up in Cordova, Spain, which is where they had started from. Cordova is not listed, but it's in the southern end of Spain. So you have, again, Babylonia is all the way on our right. We now have one ending up in Alexandria in Egypt, one in Morocco, and one in Spain. The fourth one, the Ravid, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Daud, writes, I don't know his name, and we don't know where he ended up. We have historical fact that each one of the three sages he mentions actually did live in each one of these three cities. How they ended up there, I don't know for sure. Did they travel there? We don't know. The legend goes they ended up there because they were hijacked, they were pirated, they were sold as slaves, and each one of the communities in Alexandria, in Morocco, and in Spain ransomed this great sage who had been sold as a slave. And after he had been ransomed by the community, stayed, set up a community, and now all of a sudden, your regular ho-hum community in Morocco, in Spain, in Egypt, now has a bona fide major league sage at its head, and each one of them began to establish communities where they were, and now it became a place to move to, because all of a sudden Morocco isn't no man's land. Morocco has so-and-so, the Rosh Yeshiva, who's living there. And Spain has such-and-such a Rosh Yeshiva living there, as does Egypt. And this begins, this takes place in the year 960, according to legend, and we know they lived there around this time. This is the dispersion out of Babylonia, on the bottom right hand of your map, as the Jews begin to set up major communities with major players, leaders, and sages in various areas of the world. Together with this, the world's economic center moves to Europe out of the Middle East. This area of the Tigris, the Euphrates, Babylonia, Israel, which had been the center of world civilization for so long, is now shifting into Europe. Europe is divided into two parts, which we're going to speak about a lot. You have Muslim Spain. After the Muslims come into existence in the year 600, as I mentioned last week, within 200 years, they're a powerful force taking over the world. They take over Spain in the year 715, 100, 150 years after they came into existence. Not only do they move from where they begin towards the right-hand side of the map, they push all the way to the left, pushing west through Egypt, northern Africa, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, all these modern-day countries, Morocco. They cross the Straits of Gibraltar and take over almost all of Spain, except for the northern area, pushing the Christians out of Spain. So that's part of Europe, which is now under Muslim rule together with North Africa. And then you have the Christian rule, which already took over from the year, again, the turn of the century, in the Common Era, is where Christianity is beginning. By the year 200, 300, 400, you have Constantine already creating a major Christian empire. Charlemagne, in the 600s, establishing the Holy Roman Empire. And the rest of Europe, just looking on your maps, France, Germany, all of those areas are now under Christian rule. This is the layout, the lay of the land, so to speak, in the year 900, 1000. In that time period, you have Muslim Europe, which is really Spain, what's today modern-day Portugal, and then the top of the North African continent, all the way through what today is Saudi Arabia, Iraq. That area is Muslim. And then you have the north of the Mediterranean Sea, Italy, France, Germany. That area today, modern-day Austria-Hungary, that area is under Christian rule. That's the lay of the land as far as where the Jew finds himself. As the Jew leaves Babylonia, as the Babylonian community loses its stature, loses its prominence, loses its sages, loses its infrastructure, so the Jews move. So where do they go? So they go in primarily in two directions. They basically hug the Mediterranean Sea, which we're familiar with, but they go in two different directions. The majority of the Jews head southwest. They head down to Egypt, Libya, Algeria, Morocco, Spain, that area. Why do the majority go? I'm using just the modern day nations on our map. Why do they go that way? Because who was their host when they were in Babylonia? It was the Muslims. Where do the Muslims go? That's where they went. So they followed their host, which they were much more familiar and comfortable with. It was a much more natural fit for the Jew to move in that southwesterly way across the North African continent and then into Spain, because that was their host country. That was the host culture that they had been familiar with, and they migrated in mass that way. A small minority followed the Mediterranean Sea northward up through modern-day Syria, Turkey, those areas, ending up in France and Germany. That's going to be a minority. We'll get to this again in a little bit more. But a minority go that way, a minority go this way, and this is what's going to create our Svard community, which is primarily the land of Spain. That's where that Svardic community is going to develop, North African and Spain. And the Jews that left and went more northward to end up in France and Germany are going to become our Ashkenazic community. And the Jews who are left behind in Babylonia are the real Jews. Those are the Jews that never left. They didn't go anywhere. They're just Jews. But we refer to them today as the Persian Jews. They're the Persian Jews because they never left. They never got stamped as Ashkenazi. They never got stamped as Sephardi. They're just the Persians. They've been where they've been since prior to the first temple's destruction, 586, before the Common Era. That's where the community went. One of the great tragedies in Jewish history, and Jewish history is filled with tragedies, is in our day and age, we've seen the destruction of the Persian community. In which, just now, with what's going on in the Muslim world, in Iraq and Iran, there are almost no Jews left. In our day, this happened. They existed for 2,500 years, continuously, as Jews. They were just the Jews who left from Ezekiel the prophet sent them there, and a continuous community in exile, and in our day it's been completely demolished. And now they're just the Persians. The Persians have a shul across the street. That's the community who left before the first temple. But those are the three major communities that are going to develop. We have the Persian community, which are just the Jews remaining behind in Babylonia, because whenever Jews get out of a place, there are always some who remain behind, certainly if they weren't forcibly kicked out, like we'll see in the Inquisition. So many Babylonian Jews remain. A good chunk of them leave and end up in Spain and North Africa. It's going to be our Svard community. And then you have a minority that goes more northward around the Mediterranean Sea the other way and ends up in France and Germany and some in Italy. We're not going to push eastward into White Russia, the Ukraine, Poland. That's going to happen a little bit later in Jewish history. Certainly as we get onto the Hasidic period, later 1500s, 1600s, that's when really that push more to the east happens. But even during this time period that we're discussing, we're centralized on our map. We've left the Babylonian area. We're now centralized in this part of the world. So far, so good? Okay. What I'd like to discuss with you tonight is a little bit about how these two different communities developed so that we can understand where we are today in our Sephardic communities, Ashkenazi communities. We all came from the same place. And we ended up so vastly different. So when we understand what the communities were like, where they went, we'll have a much greater understanding as to where we are today and how we got to where we are today in that understanding. Okay, so I'm in the capital letter B if you're following along inside your notes. So the lands of Sfard. So Sfard is referred to as the lands of Spain and Portugal. And as I mentioned, the majority of the Jews migrate there because it's natural for them. Because the hosts, the rulers of Sfard at that time are Muslims. They took over again, as I mentioned, in 715 in Spain. And that was the host country that the Jews lived in. So they found a very comfortable home there. What is sounds strange to us today, but was a historical fact, is that the Muslim world at this point in time is the trendsetter, is the most cultured, educated, sophisticated culture in the world at this time. Their Christian neighbors are about to enter into the dark ages that are going to take a long time to get out of. But the Muslims at this point are cutting edge of society. They are into music, they are into art, they're into poetry, philosophy. There's a religious tolerance. As long as the Jew recognized that he was second class, they were tolerant of them. As opposed to our Christian neighbors, which we're going to see was much less tolerant, even if we recognized we were second class. But in the Muslim world, as long as we knew our place, so to speak, not to say there weren't ever any problems, but overall, it was a good place to be. It was a cultured place to be. It was a place of learning. It was a place of education. It was a place where people, men, would sit on their front porches smoking their water pipes and philosophizing about life. They were into philosophy. They did that. Spain was a warm, sunny climate. Everything we're going to see about the Jews who end up in Spain, we're going to see is almost the exact opposite of what happens to the Ashkenazi Jews in almost every single way. From physical, logistical, like, environment, to the culture that they were involved in, to the religion that they were surrounded by. Night and day, these two communities. Like, when the Jew decided to leave Babylonia, it was like, well, where should we go, honey? I don't know. We could go, you know, southeast, or we could go southwest, or we could go a little northwest. Which community should we have? That decision was going to create a world of difference as to how the Jew was going to live. So the Jew who ends up in Muslim Spain, or North Africa, ends up in a place that's very cultured. Yeah.
Maybe a stupid question, but why couldn't they go back to Israel?
It's a fair question. It probably was because there was nothing to go back to. Following the destruction of the Second Temple, there was no economy. It was overrun. It wasn't a as the Torah prophesies that it will be a wasteland when you are out. So by the time this is now 900 years post the destruction, it was probably, I'm guessing, I'm not saying this with authority, it was not an option for most of them. It's a question that you would ask today where we have a state of Israel and we struggle with why should I go back, should I not go back? It doesn't seem like it was much of, it wasn't on, everybody, they went right past it. Right on the way to Egypt and then all the way around to the Iberian Peninsula, they went right past it. So it seems like, there's not things I know. It just seems like it wasn't much of an option. There always was a community there. And we'll get to that at the very end. Always. But like a major community, it was not. It's an interesting point. So the Jews find themselves in a host country that is physically, it's warm, sunny, no harsh winters, and it's cultured. And the Jews fit right in. They jump into this society, and they very quickly rise in the ranks of their host country. The Muslim area of Spain has Jewish prime ministers, Jewish bankers, there are generals in the army, there are poets. The Jewish people become very accultured and are very much ingrained and part of the society that they live in. Just to mention a couple of names that are well-known names of this time period that we should just, it's worth mentioning. Chizpe ibn Shaprut, in the very beginning of this time period, 915 to 990, was the official court physician of the caliph. Meaning, it was normal, like the caliph, the Arab caliph hired a Jew who was a clearly identified observant Jew to be the official court doctor in his court. And once he was there, he established, because of his other talents, he was a great linguist and a scholar, he became the official courtier and diplomat of the caliph. He was the one who traveled to all of the Christian neighbors and countries to be the official diplomat in between the Arabs and the Christians, as many Jews did, as we'll see. And there was an official religious Jew who had that position in this time period. Ibn Shaprut commissioned a Jew by the name of Menachem Ibn Saruk to write the first official Hebrew dictionary. And Menachem Ibn Shirk wrote what's called the Machveres. It's quoted extensively by Rashi as a ability. The way that the Hebrew dictionary was written was by working backwards. You look at Tanakh, and from the way Tanakh was written, you derive all of the laws that govern the Hebrew language. So he wrote a book coming up with what are the sharashim, what are the roots of each word, what are the different conjugations, what are the different tenses. And so he wrote, again, this was the culture of Muslim Spain, that you would write the first formal Hebrew dictionary of the Hebrew language. Ibn Saruk is almost always referred to together with Danish Ibn Lavrat, who historically, we'll just mention them together as two Hebrew linguists who wrote the dictionary. In their lifetime, they were bitter enemies, because Danish Ibn Lavrat held that Menachem Ibn Saruk didn't know what he was talking about, and that all of the roots that he derived, and the rules and the conjugations, he got them all wrong, he didn't understand language. And we could say it almost humorously today, it was not humorous at all during that time period. In fact, it was so non-humorous that Danish Ibn Lavrat claimed that Menachem Ibn Saruk was a Karaite and was using, without any of the rabbinic traditions, just a Karaitic tradition to come to an understanding of his dictionary, and that caused, as you can imagine, a whole to-do, because that makes the whole dictionary trace. You can't use a dictionary if it was written by a Karaite. He defended himself that he wasn't a Karaite. Like we look back historically, it's like a little historical footnote. Two dictionaries are written at the same time. It was a little bit contentious, but we have their dictionaries and it's really great. At the time, it was really not great. But this was the culture of a little bit into, just an insight into the Muslim world. Some of the Spaniards, some of the wealthiest people in all of Spain, and some of the famous names that we have during this time period. Isaac Abarbanel. He was this is a couple hundred years into the Spanish day, was the treasurer of the King of Portugal. Again, a scholar, he wrote a famous commentary to the Chumash, a very identified religious Jew, was the official treasurer of the country of Portugal. Abraham Senior, who was one of the wealthiest men of Spain, personally financed Columbus's trip. He financed the armies that drove the Moors out of Spain. And he personally was instrumental in creating and arranging the marriage of Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabel of Castile, which does not work out well for the Jewish people. But he was personally involved in it. And when you want to speak about not working out well for the Jewish people, he converts to Christianity during the time of the Inquisition. And he and his family leave Judaism. He had a position of power, and again, it's not one for us to judge being in a position. We're going to talk a lot more about this time period, not next week when Rabbi Feldman talks about the Rambam, but the week after that we're going to talk about the Muranos and the Jews who stayed and what life was like in Spain during this 100-year period of 1391 to 1491, during the 100-year decree that all Jews were either going to be banished or converted. It was a period in which it's almost impossible to imagine, and the way that it was dealt with in rabbinic literature, that'll be a whole discussion. So it's not one for us to judge, but he eventually converts. But just to give you a sense as to the way the Jews had integrated into society, some of the wealthiest leaders within the court system were Jewish people. Yeah? So this is already after the Spanish Reconquest. In other words, I jumped sort of very quickly from in the 715, the Muslims kicked the Christians out of Spain. The Spanish come back and reconquer Spain, moving from the north back down south. And I think it's 1100 to 1200s, and they take back the country. The Jews have a period of peace and tranquility there, and shortly thereafter things go very much downhill once the Christians come back into town. The Jewish children in Spain are taught and write in Hebrew, in Arabic. They developed Ladino. Many of them spoke Latin. It was a cultured time period. The way that the educational system worked, there were not schools. Families would hire a teacher, a Rebbe, and the Rebbe would be responsible for teaching them all of these subjects. The Rebbe was the person who would teach them art and math and philosophy, as well as, of course, Torah, but it was all part of their educational system. We're going to see the difference between the Ashkenazic educational system and the Sephardic educational system night and day. It's a dispute which still continues today. How should we educate our children? In Spain, it was very well-rounded. The children were poets. They were philosophers. They were into music and art. They were given all of that. The culture provided them with all of that, and it was part of the education that the Jewish child got. Philosophy, which has a little bit of a bad name in today's day and age when you talk about studying philosophy, in those days it included lots of other things. It included physics, medicine, astronomy, pharmacology. All of those things were included when you say a Jewish children was taught philosophy. He was taught all of the leading cutting-edge subjects in math and in science that were taught, and that was a clear part of Spanish education. Now, poetry, it's worth, again, just to give you a flavor of what it was like. In Spain during this time, poetry was what you did. When you would show up at a Sheva Brachos, you wouldn't come with a gift, you would come with a poem. And if you went to Rachman Aslan to a funeral, to a Shiva house, you came with an elegy. That's what you came with. You didn't just come with a platter of fruit. You wrote a poem about the occasion and all life cycle events. It was something that was done. And just to give you an insight into the culture, a legend that's told about this culture, which again is something which we'll see will never be told about Ashkenazic Jewry, the legend is told of two of the great Spanish philosophers and writers who we've spoken about in the past. Last year's class we discussed Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in great Jewish books. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote the book The Kuzari about the Khazar kingdom. It was a philosophical book. He was a great poet. We have many of his poems which yearn for a return to the land of Israel. He lived in Spain during this time. One of the legends of this time is that on a certain Purim, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who was living again from 1075 to 1141, just to give you a sense of where we are, was writing a Purim poem. And at his door comes a knock from Avram ibn Ezra, who was a young, aspiring sage, Talmud Chacham, in the Spanish community. And Ibn Ezra comes in, and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who's busy writing a poem, says to him, "I'm working on this acrostic, you know, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, as many of the poems do." He says, "I'm stuck on the letter Nun. I don't have the right way to begin that phrase." And as the legend goes, Ibn Ezra says to him, "Why don't you start it like this?" And he finishes the poem for him and marries the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's daughter. So goes the legend, which again, as Rabbi Wein himself mentions, we have no historical evidence that they were actually father-in-law and son-in-law, and we certainly don't have any evidence that the story is true. I share this story because they would never say such a story in Ashkenazic Jewry. It's not the legend. The legend would be the five-year-old kid came into the Rosh Hashiva, and the Rosh Hashiva says, "I'm working on a passage in the Talmud, and I'm not sure how to interpret it," and the five-year-old says, "It's like this," and he became his son-in-law 10 years later. That's how the legend would go, because it was a different community. The legends are told in Spanish-controlled Muslim communities that Avraham ibn Ezra, who writes a commentary to the Torah, became Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's son-in-law because he completed the poem he was working on. It's just an insight into the community that existed. If a child was equipped to be a poet, to be a musician, there were schools that were set up for them in that manner. It was a Muslim world. When I was talking to Rabbi Feldman just today, he just poked his head into my office, knowing that I was cramming for tonight's class. So he says, "You know, Ashkenaz and Sfarad, what are you talking about?" So I'm focusing a lot on the difference between growing up in a Muslim community or growing up in the Christian community like the Ashkenazim did. So he mentioned to me something which is a very interesting thought. He says it infiltrated even in the way that our shuls are set up. If you ever notice, the Sephardi shul is set up where a lot of Jews like sitting around the edge. They just sit around the walls. Certainly the old-fashioned Sephardi shuls. In Ashkenazim, we all sit in pews. each one mimicking the culture that we don't want to be like and where we grew up. The Ashkenazim didn't want to be like the church, but we set up our shuls in the same way that it looks just like a church. And the Muslim communities, in which they didn't want to be like the mosque, but they basically still set up a shul in which it sort of a lot of them looks like they just sit around. They're not that's an Ashkenazi thing. That's growing up in a Christian society. And even in the way that shuls are set up reflects the different types of communities that the different Jews grew up in. Anyways, one more comment about the Sephardi community. We discussed last year's class. We'll just quickly review in a moment. Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, who was one of the first Jews, sages, to come up with a codified system of the Talmud. He went through all the Talmud and he basically edited it out and condensed it into just the halacha, just the practical applications, and wrote this great book called the Halachas Gedolos, in which it was just going to be, this is what you need to know based on the Talmud. So the Rif, who lived in Fez in Morocco, in the year when he was in his 80s, was forced to flee Morocco and ends up in Spain, and he sets up a small yeshiva there. And the Rif becomes now this great leader. He was already sort of Sephardi because he grew up in Fez in Morocco, but now he's in Spain. The Rif, who becomes the leading Jewish sage of the area, has a Talmud, a student known as the Rim Migash. I believe it's Rabbi Yehuda, I believe, from Migash was the name of a city. The Rim Migash, who studied under the Rif, teaches a student by the name of Maimon. And Maimon has a son whom he teaches known as Moshe ben Maimon, we know as the Rambam. So the rabbinic tradition in Spain goes from the year about 1000, 1050, when the Rif shows up, I have my dates a little bit, around that area, 1088, to his students, which the Rambam has a direct line. His father, who was his Rebbe, studied under the principal teacher of the Rif, and that's Svardic Talmudic history. Last year when we did the course, we spent much more time describing how that line of thinking, how it plays itself out and its significance, but there is this Torah line as well through the Rif all the way down to the Rambam and then others. Any one of these Sephardic great sages has to work through that line. That's your starting point. How does the Rif understand? How does the Rim Migash? How does the Rambam? That's your that is your line. Okay, I brought here one quote just to conclude our discussion of the origin of the Sephardic community from Rabbi Wein. It's on the box on page 2. Sephardic Jewry was affluent. It was well positioned in general society. It was explosively creative in Torah scholarship, in the arts and sciences. It wore an outward expression of confidence, of optimism and security. It was indeed the golden age of Spain. That's how you would describe it. Sounds a lot how we've described our existence here in America. It was full of optimism, it was full of confidence, it was filled with security. We were well integrated into society, all aspects of society, leadership roles in the arts and the sciences and mathematics, in Torah study. It was all flourishing. The Spanish community is going to exist for nearly 800 years. 800 years, you can imagine. We feel, most of us in this room, American. Those of us for sure who had parents are American, great-grandparents are American. Imagine if you were living in Spain and you're the 600th year there. You don't know anything else. Your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and their great-great-grandparents had all lived in Spain, and the Jewish community of Spain was sure that they would be there forever until they ended up back in Eretz Yisrael. They were just so rooted and part and integrated into society. When the Christians come back, reconquer Spain, things turn fairly quickly. And as we'll see in a few more minutes, we'll get to the great trauma of Spain. But for most of Spanish existence, there was a short 70-year period where the Alahides came up from North Africa. They're a fanatical group of Muslims, and they overran the country until they were pushed back. Except for that 70-year period, which happens to be the 70-year period during which the Rambam lived, and he was forced to flee because of that. But other than that 70-year period, it was an overwhelmingly positive golden age of Spain for Spanish Jewry. That's where the Sephardic community grows up in. And it's worth noting, Rabbi Wein, when he was here, mentioned that when you look back historically, so I could say something very quickly, like over 600 years, it was great. There was one 70-year period where it was really unpleasant. If you happened to have been born in the middle of that 70-year period and died during that 70-year period, you would think the world is ending. Like these fanatical Arabs have come in, they've overrun the country, it's a disaster. So historically, you have to like scale back and you say, oh yeah, it was a great period, it was a 70-year blip, but like whatever. But if you lived during that, if that was your existence, I only lived for my 50, 60, 70 years and it happened to have been there, So life was pretty bad in Spain. And you sometimes would have to see historically, at the end of the day, history speaks that it was good for the Jews until a point, and then, as we'll see in a few moments, it completely crashed. In any case, that's our Sephardic Jewish community. The Ashkenazic community, which travels north up the Mediterranean coast, ends up in France and Germany, night and day from what the Spanish Jews were privileged to. Okay, now, in France and in Germany, the Jews are a highly literate, educated minority. The Jews have always been literate because we're people of the book. The first thing we teach our children is to be able to learn, to be able to read. We're a literate group no matter what's going on around us. Well, in the Muslim countries, so everybody was literate. There were schools and art and music and philosophy, so we fit right in. In the land of France and Germany at this time, we didn't fit in at all. We were surrounded in a highly illiterate age. It wasn't just illiterate, but it was boorish, it was drunk, they were violent, they were highly superstitious Christian society. And we find ourselves in the midst of this society. Cold, dark winters, it's just in every way just completely the opposite of the experience that our Muslim cousins had. The society at this time, we're literally in the Dark Ages. In the Dark Ages, we have almost no understanding of sanitation, health, medicine. The doctors of those times were probably more dangerous than the illnesses they were trying to cure. They just didn't have an understanding of that which was going on. It was a society which believed in demons and fairies and witches. No accurate measures of time, calendar, clocks, literally the Dark Ages. Now the Jews, in the midst of all this, have all of our things in which we're not like that. We have to have a calendar. We have to have an accurate sense of time. We have to know when Shabbos starts and when Shabbos ends and how much we have to eat on Pesach and this, that, and the other. We have Netilas Yadayim, we're washing our hands all the time. So we just have all of these practices that don't fit into the society around us and make us different. And those of us, those of you at my Chumash here that we gave the Shabbos morning, spoke about the concept of how the majority looks at a minority that distinguishes itself as different. And we were very different in almost every way. And not only were we just different, but our Christian hosts looked at us as if we killed their God. So we weren't just different. We weren't just literate. We weren't just a little bit more sophisticated, we were also guilty of deicide. It was not a good mix for most of our existence in that period. Let me take one step back before we take a step forward. Jewish communities existed in this area for a long time before where we are right now, in the year 900, 1000, 1100. Before this time already, there were Jewish communities in France and in Germany. There's a famous legend, again, another legend that we have, that during the period of the first destruction, again 500 before the Common Era, first temple is destroyed, almost all the Jews go to Babylonia, there was already a small group which migrated north and ended up in Germany during that time. And we have a legend that says that when Ezra the prophet called all the Jews back to rebuild the second temple and said, "We're going home, come, return," that they wrote him back and they said, "You go back and rebuild your Jerusalem. We're just fine here in our Jerusalem of Germany. We're not coming back with you." And Jewish legend has it that because of that haughty response, this is back from the time of Ezra, that it was said on that community that the destruction of the Crusades, which was going to wipe out the German community, was a result of the haughty response of the Jews of Germany then. And that was, this legend developed way before we knew what Germany was capable of. Even before then already, Germany has been shrouded in Jewish blood, and it dates by legend all the way back to the time of Ezra and the return in which the Jews refused to come back to take part of the second temple. But anyway, there are communities there. There are Jews who are there. Charlemagne invites the Jews in the 600s as he's creating his Holy Roman Empire also to come and help develop the infrastructure. The Holy Roman Empire, the famous quip, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, was neither holy nor Roman, nor was it an empire. But nonetheless, he invites the Jews in, and the Jews begin to settle some of the land. And then the Jews begin to migrate from Babylonia into these communities. At around the time of Rashi, 1040, it's a very small community. We're talking literally, there are different ways of describing the numbers. The historians use 5,000 Jews, 10,000 Jews, 350 families. It's small. And it's from this small group that the entire Ashkenazic community is going to develop. Because it is so small, when a Jew claims, yeah, I'm descended from Rashi, it's probably true. Between Rashi and his family, almost all of Ashkenazic Jewry is indeed descended from Rashi in one shape, one way or another. It's also the source of what, which are unfortunately very familiar with Ashkenazic genetic diseases. The reason why that exists, why are there Ashkenazic Jewish diseases? It's because the millions of Ashkenazi Jews that exist today are all descended from a very small pool of 5,000 Jews, maybe 350 families, and everybody married each other because that's all there was. You were isolated from the rest of the Jewish world in Ashkenaz. You were very far from the Babylonian Jews. You were in a Christian society. Your closest neighbors were in the Muslim-controlled Spain. It was not simple. That's where you were. That's where the community developed. It was from a very small pool that the entire Ashkenazic community develops. That's just the reality as to how it got started. This group was not integrated into society. It was not like the Sephardic Jews who take up positions, who are involved in art and music and literature. It is a highly insulated group of Jews, and they were not interested in anything other than the Talmud. They had no interest. Not that the society had much to offer by way of art and music and culture during this dark age period of Jewish history, of world history, but the Jews themselves, philosophically, were opposed to teaching their children philosophy and art and music and literature. It was Torah and Torah and Torah and Talmud and Talmud and Talmud. It was the nature of the community. And again, as I mentioned before, this exists today. The Jewish world is, this is not new to the Jewish world, that there are Jews who think it's a mitzvah to teach your child arts and philosophy and music. And there are Jews who think that it's prohibited by pain of death to teach your child music and art and literature. It's just Torah, Torah, Torah versus a more. What? This existed in the beginning of our Ashkenaz Sephardic community. These two approaches to education, these two approaches to life, already existed. The Ashkenazic community, the legends they would tell in Ashkenaz are very different than the one I shared earlier from Sephard. It was about adeptness, it was about in Talmud study, and how clear one was able to master the Talmud. The Jews themselves already begin to live in ghettos during this time period because it was a protection. It was just safer for them to be amongst themselves. They did not integrate the way our Sephardic cousins did. The leader of Ashkenazic Jewry is known as Rabbeinu Gershom or Hagola, the light of the exile, who had a small yeshiva in Mainz. When I say small yeshiva, like 30, 40 boys. We're not talking like yeshivas in like Mir and Yerushalayim now, 1,000 students. The whole community was pretty small. He had a small yeshiva. And his yeshiva and his force of personality really ends Babylonian supremacy, so to speak, because he was such a larger-than-life figure, Rabbeinu Gershom, that the center of even this part of the world then moves upwards from Babylonia to this area of France and Germany, the lands of Ashkenaz. I mentioned Rabbeinu Gershom because of a number of institutions which he created together with the gathering of the rabbis of the time, which still are in effect today and have had a major impact on Jewish life. And I want to put them in the social context of what was going on in Ashkenaz as opposed to what was going on in Sephard, which is why till today we have these differences between Ashkenaz and Sephardic customs. Rabbeinu Gershom came up with a number of edicts, which are known as the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom. Cherem means literally to be put in, Cherem to be put in excommunication, and to be excommunicated for anyone who would violate any of these rules which he put into effect, which we are familiar with. But these got started, so it says in the Torah that a man's allowed to have multiple wives. Why are we not allowed to have them today? Because of the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom, as the land of Ashkenaz is being developed in Christian society, he comes up with the following series, which we'll go through briefly now. Number one and primary amongst them is that he outlaws polygamy. Hereby, according to the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom, forbidden for a man to have multiple wives. It begins somewhere in the year 980 or around the year 1000. During that time period, is that accepted? But it's only binding on the Jews who were part of that world in which he makes that, which is the Ashkenazic world. The Sephardic world They didn't hear of it for sure. Who knows when they first even heard of it, but they never accepted it as binding. It's not even until the modern state of Israel and many of the Sephardic Jews returned there that for many of those communities that they even till today accepted it. And what's the problem? They weren't part of this world of Rabbeinu Gershom who took it, but Ashkenazic Jewry has not had a polygamous relationship since around this time of about a year 1000. It is suggested that one of the reasons why this came into why now? Because in Christian society, the way that they looked at human male-female relationships was with such an eye of evil, such an eye of it being something dirty or impure, that for the Jew to survive in it, not only to say that marriage is holy, but to have multiple wives made them look in the eyes of their hosts as something particularly, let's call it distasteful, just to use a simple word. And so it's suggested that in that world, like we look at it in today's world, we say, why did he do that? Well, of course we didn't. We know why he did it. It makes a lot of sense. But when it started, they were doing just fine with multiple wives before. Then why did he come up? Because the culture in which he was didn't allow for it. Wouldn't have worked. So he instituted, that's again, that's just a suggestion. The bottom line is he forbade it, and it was accepted by Ashkenazic Jewry, and that was the end of multiple wives. He also instituted a new rule that a woman is not allowed to be divorced against her will, which goes hand in hand with the first rule. First law that he banned polygamy, so now you only have one wife. So there was a fear that now there's only one wife, so a man would be too quick to divorce her and find someone else because he used to have four or five or six, but now he's only going to have one. So he instituted that it was forbidden for the Rav who was being massaged, the Gittin, to give a woman a get against. Well, according to Torah law, it's not a problem. A wife does not have the authority to reject the get. If a husband wants to divorce his wife, he can, against her will. Rabbeinu Gershom is the source that until today, this is in practice, is a Rav will not give a woman a get on behalf of her husband if it's against her will, and the get will not be effective. A woman has to be a participant in the divorce. He also instituted an automatic reacceptance of returning Jews from Christianity. During this time period, it's going to be, as we're going to see, it's only going to grow and get worse. Christians trying to force Jews to convert. Well, what happens when they converted and they wanted to come back? So we've mentioned this a number of times over the years as well. What it was like socially to be in a shul. Just picture today, everything is fine, and then troubles hit, and society falls apart, and there are pogroms, and every family has a loss in their family because there are marauding bands of Christians who are slaughtering innocents. And then the one family says, okay, we're out, we want to convert. And meanwhile, everybody's licking their wounds, they have family members who have perished, the infrastructure of the city is demolished, everybody's in poverty, and then things get better 5 years later, and the family, with all their wealth, and all their comforts, and everybody in their family alive, shows up in shul and says, I want to come back. So we can look at it historically and say, Baruch Hashem, they came back. Not so simple. Not so simple. They want an aliyah on Yom Kippur. And they want to be buried in the Jewish cemetery. Not so simple. So Rabbeinu Gershom was the first assumption. We're going to see this as we go on throughout this element of our history, what it was like socially in communities. We're going to talk about this again when we talk about the Muranos. And then throughout Christian Europe, when a family comes back, do we take them or do we not take them back? And he established, absolutely we take them back. And Rashi was going to continue this, and it was a policy the Jewish people had. And the reason why we needed a policy is because it was not so simple that you wouldn't need a policy if grassroots, of course, if everybody said, absolutely, come on back, you wouldn't need a policy. But there was a policy because it wasn't so simple. And he established that that's the way that it was going to be. If a Jew comes back, a Jew comes back and he's allowed back into the community. His fourth edict was the prohibition of opening and reading other people's mail. Now, for our modern ears, of course that's prohibited. So that wasn't always an of course. And in the times of commerce in those days, where the Jew was actually often the go-between between the Christian world and the Muslim world, it was actually critical for his survival to be able to know with security that letters that he wrote from one person to another person were going to make it. One historian I saw quoted writes something, I don't have it exactly in front of me, says, commerce during this period of time was based on the fact that if Jacob in Italy trusted his cousin Moses in Spain, and was able to be in contact with his cousin Abraham in Morocco, so everything would work out well. Because they, you know, that's how the Jews, they were able to transfer all the different lands. But they needed to be able to communicate in order for that to be able to work, that they can get through all these different lands, all the different Jews, And the Rabbeinu Gershom established that prohibition based on the Chaim Rabbeinu Gershom, and Jewish people would write on the back of their letters, they would seal it with a Ches Gimel, with the Chaim of Rabbeinu Gershom. It's prohibited to open this, and when the person would receive the letter, they would see the seal that the person had wrote on top of the letters, that it was based on the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom to be opened, and he knew that he got it, and nobody had and read it. These were Ashkenazic customs that Rabbeinu Gershom had established and became part of the Jewish world. Rabbeinu Gershom dies in the year 1040. Sorry, I can't believe how fast the time goes. Rabbeinu Gershom dies in 1040. You notice Rashi is born in 1040. Rashi becomes then the pillar of light in Ashkenazic Jewry, the house of Rashi. Rashi himself is unparalleled in Jewish life. He creates literally a dynasty. Rashi has three daughters. Famous daughters of Rashi. Some say there's a fourth daughter. All of Rashi's daughters, there are many legends about them. What seems to be pretty agreed upon is that they were very well educated, which was abnormal for men in the Dark Ages. Jewish men a little bit more, but for Jewish women to be as educated as they were clearly was abnormal. They served as the secretaries. They were very, they knew. They were well-educated women. They all married Talmidei Chacham of these three daughters. And each one of those daughters had children who followed in the school of Rashi. They became known as the Baalei Tosafos, Rabbeinu Tam, the Ri, Rabbeinu Yitzchak. There is a whole series that we can give a whole class on the house of Rashi, but it stems from him in the development of Ashkenazic Jewry. And again, this house of Rashi was a Torah-based house. That's what they studied, that's what they did, that's what they focused on. Rabbi Wein has a quote which is magnificent. You can read it on your own. I don't want to spend the time reading it out loud. But I couldn't parallel it in my own words, and his words are so eloquent in describing the brilliance of what Rashi has left us. Literally unparalleled in the Rashi's ability to teach us as children, to teach us as teenagers, to teach us as adults, to teach us in our old age. Rashi, the same Rashi, just has the ability to do all of that in his non-judgmental way, in his love of the Jewish people. It's a beautiful quote. I have it on the top of three. I highly recommend, because of time constraints, I'm not going to read it aloud, but read it just to get an appreciation of who Rashi is. And that's the development of Ashkenazic Jewry through the tradition of what we call the Rishonim through this time period. Both communities end up with tremendous amounts of trauma and tragedies. I've been mentioning a little bit, just to mention a quick word. But the differences in the type of tragedy, again, define the community. The Crusades, which begin in 1096, is relatively early in the Ashkenazic stay in these lands. They get to Germany, France, in 900, 1000. That's where the community really begins. Rabbeinu Gershom was the first great leader, dies in the year 1040. Rashi's born in 1040. By 1096, we already have the Christian Pope Urban II calling for the first crusade. The Crusades last for 200 years. There are 7, 8, 9 Crusades. 200 years of disaster for the Jewish communities along the way of the crusading bands as they go to the land of Israel to redeem the Holy Land from the infidels, from the Muslims. So it's really a Muslim-Christian battle, and the Jews bear the brunt of it, as often happens. The point that I want to bring out is this trauma and the tragedy that destroys communities, the Jews live through it. They don't end up leaving the lands of Ashkenaz. They just are moving one community to another community. But the trauma of the Crusades, which is a long, drawn-out trauma, 200 years means 4 or 5 generations of a family lives through the Crusades. It's not something that, let's say, even just now with the Holocaust. So it happened, so let's say my family. So my grandparents lived through it. So for me, my grandparents, I have a connection. My children hear the stories that I tell about what happens, but they're living in the lap of luxury, in the safety and the security of America. B'li Ayin Hara is right. Because any student of Jewish history knows, as it happened in Spain and in all the communities, that's where we live right now. 200 years means you didn't know anything else. Generation after generation after generation grew up with, when's the next band coming through? Well, that's going to define a society. There were Jewish poets in Ashkenaz. They wrote poetry. But their poetry was not like the poetry of the Spanish Jews, the Sfardim, who wrote non-religious poetry. They mused about life and philosophy and the foibles of the human condition. Jewish Ashkenazic poetry was a dirge. It was always serious, it was heavy, and it was always Torah-based, about the exile and the pains of suffering of the exile. Because that's what life was like. Even today, Shabbat Zemiros, you know, if someone starts a song, it's like, well, which part of the world did this come from? Baruch Kel Elyon Hashem. Where was that from? That's not an old tune that the Spaniards sang. That's European. That's the air of Ashkenazic Jewry, where life was a dirge, and your Shabbos Zemiros reflected that. Because life was tough. It was. It was unpleasant. You were surrounded constantly by fear from your non-Jewish neighbors. And all of life sort of reflects that as the Ashkenazic community develops, as it's going to move, even through as we move eastward into the Ukraine and into White Russia, that part of Ashkenazic tradition does not change. It's not any better for us as we move to Russia, to the Ukraine, and to those lands, to the Caucasus. It's still that same existence of, I'm always afraid of when will the next pogrom be. Because that's what it was like. You were protecting yourself. You were trying to survive. And Ashkenazic Jewry has that. It's part of our DNA almost, that we're waiting. We're on edge. We don't know what to do with ourselves here in America. It's been so many years already, but that is part of what it was like for the Crusades and what it did to the Ashkenazic community. Spanish Jewry was not insulated from its own trauma, what we refer to as the Inquisition. The Inquisition really is a very specific term. The Inquisition is what was set up to hunt out the Jews who were pretending to be Christians. The Inquisition was the end of a 100-year disaster, which begins in 1391, after the Christians come back and take over Spain and push the Muslims back out. So in 1391, James II of Aragon decrees expulsion for the Jews. He's finished with them. He's going to kick them out, either convert, die, or get out. And the Jews, because they're wealthy and they're powerful and they have major connections, some of whom we mentioned earlier, get a 100-year stay of the decree, that it's not going to be put into place. But that's from the king's perspective. Meanwhile, massive pogroms break out immediately in 1391 and continue for the next 100 years, which culminate in what we know as the Spanish Inquisition of 1491. That was the end of a 100-year disaster. What we'll talk about when we talk about the Muranos is that 100-year period. What was life like in Spain after 500 years of tranquility? 500 years of becoming wealthy, influential poets, mathematicians, artists, leading cutting-edge members of society. The Christians come in and it falls apart, and it's a 100-year disaster. But what happens is it marks the end of Sephardic Jewry in Spain. They don't live through it the way the Ashkenazic community for literally hundreds of years just lived with pogroms. Spanish Jewry ends. 1491, that's it. We're kicked out. 250,000 Jews will either convert or die in the Spanish Inquisition. That's the end of the Spanish community. They go to Portugal. 5 years later, they're kicked out of Portugal. It doesn't last much longer there, and they leave. So the Sephardic community develops in relative golden age, and then it comes crashing down, and they're out, as opposed to the Ashkenazic, which we just continue to live through it. And that also has an impact on a larger community in terms of how it develops. Okay, I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to briefly mention there are two other independent communities at this time, one in Italy and one in Provence. Italy, you see on your map, it's that big yellow right in the middle of the map. The Jews end up there already during the times of the Second Destruction. The Romans come, they destroy, they bring a lot of Jews back to Rome and Italy, and communities develop there. The Italian community wasn't really Svard and it wasn't really Ashkenaz. It was isolated from both and develops in its own sort of way. as do the Jews of Provence, which is southern France. So there are these within the Ashkenazic world, which is developing in France and Germany, within the Sephardic world developing in Spain and Portugal and North Africa. There are other more independent Jewish communities of Italy and in Provence, and there are communities today which have their own minhagim. They're not fully Sephardic, they're not fully Ashkenazic, they're sort of in the middle, but I just briefly mention it. What I want to conclude with tonight is the melding of these two worlds. These two worlds which develop on their own. Again, there's no email, there's no texting, communication between the Sephardic world and the Ashkenazic world, besides for the disasters of, you know, this, how backwards the Dark Ages were in general. It wasn't simple communication. So the lands, they develop their own customs, they develop into their own worlds. The Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, is going to meld these two worlds. This book is written in the late 1500s, so the communities are already pretty old and established. And this is one of the just amazing elements of divine intervention as to how Hashem is like taking worlds which were splitting apart and beginning to bring them back together a little bit. Rabbi Yosef Cairo is a name that we discussed in our great Jewish books course last year. Rabbi Yosef Cairo was 4 years old in 1491 when the Jewish people are exiled from Spain. So he grew up as an expellee from Spain. It was until World War II, the greatest trauma in Jewish history was the expulsion from Spain. It just uprooted a world which had existed for 800 years, and everybody, those who left had nothing. Their shirts on their back, and the rest were either converted or killed. So he was from that group of people. He wanders the world a little bit and ends up in Tzfat. And this is where the Jews begin to return to Eretz Yisrael. Whenever in Jewish history there's a major trauma, there's always a gut reaction of the Jewish people. Mashiach is coming. This is the harbinger of the Messianic age. That's been our response as a people for 2,000 years of exile. Every major trauma along the way, this must be it. So the expulsion from Spain was so enormous, so beyond what anyone can imagine. A major community, major group of Jews moved back to Tzfat and to Yerushalayim. This is where they begin to resettle the land. They're always again with some small communities. They begin to go back and they begin to prepare for Mashiach. We're going to learn one of our courses that we're going to learn this year is the Great Smicha Controversy. So I'm just want to tie in the different. It's going to be in a number of weeks because I'm doing a whole big chunk of time. We're going to go back to the Rambam in the 1200s. We're going to do something in the 1300s. We're eventually going to get to the Great Smicha Controversy, which is with Rabbi Yosef Cairo we're talking about right now, because the Jews in Eretz Yisrael at the time were sure Mashiach was coming, and in order for Mashiach to come, there has to be a Sanhedrin, a great court. In order for there to be a great Beis Din, somebody, the rabbis, have to have Smicha. But nobody had smicha. You have to have smicha from somebody who had smicha, from somebody who had smicha, from somebody who had smicha, who got it from Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, they hadn't had it in 500 to 1,000 years. So there was a way to bring it back. The Rambam writes that you can bring it back if you gather all the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael. They can reestablish smicha, and that was done, and they granted smicha to Rabbi Yosef Cairo. This created a huge controversy, so huge it's going to have a course unto itself, which we're going to talk about. But just I want to mention as many things as I can so everybody gets all this straight when you come across it. So Rabbi Yosef Cairo is living in Tzfat. He's living in a time and an age where the Jews are sure Mashiach is around the corner because of the tragedy which just took place. And he writes what's known as the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is the code of Jewish law, and he was just a genius of a giant of a man. And he writes in four different volumes, going through monetary law, laws between men and women, laws between daily living, and ritual law like slaughtering and mikvos. He has four different sections, and he codifies the book of Jewish law. He bases his law on three giants before him: the Rambam, the Rif, who I mentioned was the Rambam's father's Rebbe's Rebbe, and the Rush. The Rush, Rav Asher, I'm blanking on his last name, Rabbeinu Asher. Forgot. We mentioned him in our great Jewish books course. He was an Ashkenazi rabbi who fled from the Crusades and ends up in Spain. He was one of the first people who combined these worlds, because all of a sudden this Ashkenazi Talmud Chacham shows up in a Sfarish community, and he had to navigate that. But in any case, the Shulchan Aruch takes these three giants, the Rush, the Rif, and the Rambam, and writes his code of Jewish law based on the majority as to how they ruled on various matters. At the exact same time, Rav Moshe Isserles, who was a leader in Krakow in Poland, as the Jews are beginning to migrate east, And he wanted to write a work on his own that accomplished the same thing, except that Rabbi Yosef Karo beat him to it. But Rabbi Moshe Ishulis writes, but when I read his work, I saw that he left a lot of room for me, because he only took into account these three giants, all of whom had major Svardi connections. The Rambam and the Rif were full-fledged Svardi, and the Rosh was a Rav in the Svardic land. So he's not taking into account all of the Ashkenazi customs. So what Moshe Ishulis did in an act of tremendous, whether or not we call it divine guidance, inspiration, is instead of writing a separate Shulchan Aruch for Ashkenazim, what he did is he added his Ashkenazic glosses to the Shulchan Aruch, so that it's one work. That decision has had such a major impact on the Jewish world, because instead of having this continuation of separate worlds, a book of Svardi Halacha and a book of Ashkenazi Halacha, it's now one book. And every Svardi now is well-versed with Ashkenazi Halacha, and every Ashkenazi is well-versed with Svardi, because you have to read it together. The words flow one to another. And even though they're different customs, so for example, if you look in the laws of Chanukah, the Rabbi Yosef Karo will write that the halacha is you have one menorah per family. The gloss to that coming from Rabbi Moshe Ishulis, the Rama, is our custom is everybody in their family lights their own menorah. So in the same book, you have the two different customs for the Sfardim and for the Ashkenazim. But it was combined into that book in the mid-1500s, and now every book of halacha that's ever been written since takes the Shulchan Aruch into account, which is a combining of these two worlds, at least in that manner. The Rama, as an Ashkenazi posek, also introduces customs which are unique to the land of Ashkenaz. Primarily, I mentioned this earlier, kitnios. In Ashkenazic lands, the custom was not to eat kitnios. In the Sephardic lands, they never heard of such a thing. So the Sephardic, very nice, it's in the Shulchan Aruch, that's an Ashkenazic custom, and they say, very nice, I'm glad for you that you don't eat kitnios. But in Ashkenazic lands, it became part and parcel of our world in terms of Pesach halacha, and never was adopted by the Sephardic world. So even though it's in the book together, the Sephardim do not keep such a halacha, and the Ashkenazim do. And they, even as the Sephardim were expelled from Spain, so now they begin to migrate to different parts of the world. They migrate to some Ashkenazic communities. They migrate down south to the North African continent, which was still Sephardic. And there's this beginning of this intermingling, even though they still remain separate. Let me make one last point, and then I will let you go. This community, which develops, so again, it's in our great controversies class. It's not really much of a controversy. It's just two different worlds that develop through the exile. The understanding of this still maintains itself, and it's playing itself out, not just in Toco Hills, in which we have a shul across the street for Israeli / Sephardim who do things a little bit differently and eat a little bit different foods, as we now, all of us, ended up in America. So it's funny, like, America, it's not Ashkenazi or Sephardi, it's just wherever we came from. So the majority of American Jews maybe came from Eastern Europe after the war, so they established Ashkenazi communities, and many Sephardim have coming out of Iran, Iraq, and other lands. So we have, it within our own midst, a little bit of both, but it's really playing itself out in Eretz Yisrael until today. Just an interesting, just historical point. Who has been in the land of Israel since the destruction of the temple are more Sephardi Jews. They're the Jews who were exiled to Babylonia. Some stayed, and then a good number of them came back, as I mentioned a few moments ago, in the early 1500s, after the expulsion from Spain, many Jews came back and settled in Tzfat in the north, and in Yerushalayim. What types of Jews were those? Those were Sephardi. They were the expulsion, the Jews who were expelled from Spain, and they reestablished the communities in Tzfat and in Yerushalayim. It was a Sephardi community that existed there, and remained there. Fast forward to the early 1900s, in the beginnings of the Zionist movement. What types of Jews, now again, they're secular Jews, but what type of Jews are they? They're all Ashkenazi Jews. They're Jews from the Hasidic world. Most of them are secularized, but they've come from Eastern Europe, and they've come from Germany. They're Ashkenazi Jews who now infiltrate, so to speak, into the land of Israel. But what type of community is there already? The Jews who are there are Sephardi. It's not a strong, large community, but it is a Sephardi community. Now these Jews come in and they're passionate and they're going to build the land, which they do, but it's now an Ashkenazi takeover, so to speak, who are now coming, who are educated, who are, they're secular from Berlin, so they're now on the cutting edge of all that the world has to offer, they have it. And so they're the ones who are going to set up a society. There was a pre-existing Sephardi community. Now the Middle Eastern part of this world was not nearly as technologically or educationally advanced as these secular Jews who are coming in. So who's going to take over? Who's going to establish the new flavor? The Ashkenazim. The state is born. And who is the first major influx of Jews? From Iraq and Iran, hundreds of thousands come in, because as soon as a state is created, the Muslim countries in which they were hosted, which had been relatively peaceful for them, until the state is founded, they turn, major pogroms break out in Syria and Iraq, and the Jews flee, and they are Sephardi. So what happens now in the state is the small Ashkenazi but strong force is establishing the flavor. There's already a pre-existing Sephardi community. Sephardi come in droves, but what do they come with? They come with nothing. They come with the shirts on their back, and they're coming from Arab countries, which were not like the Arab countries of Spain at the turn of the 1000, which were... These Arab countries are now way behind in almost every way their Ashkenazi counterparts in terms of the civilization development of their countries. And so you have, which is until today, an ongoing issue between the Ashkenazi world of Eretz Yisrael, the Sephardi world, in the eulogies that were said for Rav Avadi Yosef of blessed memory in the last month. One of the things which was said over and over and over again was, he stood for restoring the pride and place in Jewish life of the Sephardi community. Because it didn't have that place as the state was being created, and he stood for just to recreate that and give them their place that they have as bearers of a strong tradition within Jewish life, which was it's all part of the mash of taking from the exile out of the Babylonian area where the Jews disperse, and they create the Persian community of those who remain behind. They create the Ashkenazi community, which starts off very small and explodes into the Eastern European Jewish community, which most of us are probably descended from. And you have the Sephardi community of Spain, which gets expelled and then finds its own place because it doesn't have a place anymore. And then all of us are now having to come back to one tiny little piece of land and figure out a way to make that all work with all the different customs that have developed over the centuries, all the different ways of life, all the different traditions. We do learn secular studies, we don't. It's a mitzvah to be well-rounded, it's forbidden to be... All these different things are now coming together in a very volatile situation in this small piece of land. That's part of the pains of Mashiach, is getting us, you know, figuring all of this out. But it starts from this period that we were discussing tonight. Yeah?
I just wondered what the percentages are approximately.
That I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know. When you think about what's going on in the world, most of the Sephardic communities today, meaning Jews who are living in Arab countries, the Arab world has turned on the Jews in a way that the Christian world has not. So they're all fleeing. Iraq, Iran, Syria. They were major Jewish communities in all of those lands. And they're all gone. They all moved to Israel. Some of the Western world, like where we are here today, so in England, these are Ashkenazi communities, so we're still in relative peace and tranquility, so we haven't left yet. You know, that's the story of Jewish history, is we leave when we have to. So most of the Sephardic communities have had to, and they have left. So the numbers are in the beginning of the state, were very much skewed, in which you had the ruling class, so to speak, was the Ashkenazi Jews, and they were absorbing inordinate numbers of Sephardi Jews. And that's where a lot of... It was not simple. I'm not even professing to be any... Yeah, the attitude was not great. No, it's still not great. This is all part of us figuring, you know, everything out together. To understand, you know, how we all got to where we got. Neither here nor there. And the bottom line is, there's much to talk about here. These are just some broad strokes and some developments, which is not a controversy in itself, but it's just the development of the Jewish people in its own separate branches as to an understanding of how we got to where we got to. And as we go on, in other courses that we have, this will come up over and over again, the differences between the Ashkenazic and the Sephardi communities. And next week, again, you have a week off, Enjoy your holiday Hanukkah weekend. 2 weeks from tonight, Rabbi Feldman will be teaching the controversy surrounding the Rambam. Have a great night.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.